Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 29th of July. Very nice to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about this morning. Lots happened over the weekend. We were, of course, at Tanglewood on Friday, so we'll catch up a little bit on what we missed on Friday, and we'll get going. Let me introduce the panel to you. First, we welcome Libby Post to the show. She is a political consultant and our good friend. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm sorry I'm wearing sunglasses in the studio. My regular glasses broke.
Oh.
And I am not that cool to be able to pull off wearing sunglasses on the inside.
Can you see, though?
Okay, yes, sort of, but I really like a lot of light.
Okay, all right, well.
You are so cool, Libby.
Oh, yeah.
We'll spotlight you.
Yeah. We love you.
Yeah, thanks, honey.
All right. Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson, who directs the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. And Jim Henler joins us once again. He's the Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, but wait, there's more, and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration.
Morning.
That's a lot. Wow. But good for
I figured
you.
That way I don't have to speak as much.
No.
You're all set.
I haven't even told you the other two titles.
No, no. Wow. Well, if you want them included, let me know. And
no, please.
And then work it out with your fellow panelists. Well,
because it's less time for us, Jim.
Good morning, everybody. I was going to... You know, we have a lot to talk about today. Obviously, I want to talk about Baltimore, and I want to talk about other things going on, including, let me get my list in front of me. There we go. Also, of course, the resignation of Dan Coats. However, there was the shooting overnight, which I would like to just talk about for a moment. And that is yet another and yet also very sad. And this is what we know at this point. As of right now, three people killed, at least 12 more people were injured at a garlic festival in Gilroy, California. The authorities said that an officer fatally shot the suspect carrying a rifle. Late Sunday evening, a search was underway for a possible accomplice, and we don't know exactly what happened as far as what the motivation was for such a killing. But we do know that a suspect carrying an assault-style rifle was fatally shot by the Gilroy police. The police were continuing to search for possible accomplice. It's 30 miles southeast of San Jose. And from a six-year-old boy who had been playing on an inflatable bounce house was among those killed, according to his father. The boy was shot in the back, said his father. He added that his wife had been shot in the stomach and his mother-in-law in the leg. And it happened around 5:40 local time yesterday. And, of course, a nightmare situation. We don't expect these things. We don't expect these things at school. At least we shouldn't. And yet they've become more and more common. And a summer garlic festival seems like a safe place that you could bring your kids.
Yeah. It's just, you know, and you'll have maybe the president or Trump and most likely the NRA making excuses. Well, if more people there had had guns, they would have been able to shot the guy. No, just more people would have been killed. I haven't seen any tweets or posts about thoughts and prayers, but at this point, that's all very hollow because it doesn't really matter. Thoughts and prayers are lovely. But we need legislation and we need government action to cut down on the guns. There's no reason for us for mass shootings to now be a common everyday occurrence in the United States.
And for us to have to prepare that way. My husband and I went to a concert at SPAC this summer, and I noticed there were two individuals with automatic rifles, police officers, individuals. And I thought, oh, that seems aggressive. This is Dave Matthews Band concert. Like, it's a very chill atmosphere. My husband reminded me that like this was the most sensitive area in all of SPAC was the place where you go through the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, right. So that's why we have people with automatic weapons here as opposed to laws that would prevent the need for those individuals to be there and put their lives on the line for that.
Well, I think it's also possible. Oh, I'm here also, Joe.
I not introduce you, Alan?
No, that's okay. I just wanted to mention the Blueberry Festival.
Go ahead. Did you play yesterday?
Yes, we did.
How did it go?
It was terrific. And I was thinking, it's a great place, the Austerlitz Blueberry Festival. They have a lot of people there. And like Sarah, it occurs to you when you're in a place like that with a lot of people that it attracts these crazies. A lot of little children. A six-year-old child killed. Now, we have 2 6-year-old grandchildren and via different kids or close to 6 years old. And, you know, the idea that these kids could be wiped off the face of the earth because of a madman. And yes, don't write me letters about using the word madman because they are madmen. You really have a sense at how vulnerable we all are and how for simple political reasons, people like Trump and his colleagues at the NRA and the rest of them will never do what's right for the people of America. They'll do what's right for them politically. It's that simple.
And their profit margin. We can't forget that this is all about gun manufacturers and their profits.
Yep.
It's just that simple, and they don't care about how many lives are taken. We have to remember that, you know, what's his face? The guy who went to Siena, who's the number two or the number one at LaPierre, who's, by the way, a Siena graduate. In the 80s, when they did the weapons ban bill, he testified in favor of it for an incredibly racist reason. Mm-hmm. He didn't want people of color to get their hands on semi-automatic weapons. He was pretty clear about that, about wanting those communities to, you know, foment more violence against white people. It's basically what his message is. Now, they're like, no, everybody should have one. And there's no reason why anyone should have a weapon of war, because that's what these guns are. And
so, Libby, what's the way? I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so in case people haven't been following it, the Gilroy shooting was once again a semi-automatic
weapon. So, Libby, or panelists, what's the way out for now? I mean, we all know how bad this is, but there's got to be a way out, isn't there?
Cory Booker has one of the most progressive and aggressive plans. And if you go and look at his platform on this, he and I believe Elizabeth Warren both have the most aggressive policies to curb gun violence without infringing on the individual right to bear arms.
So can you give us an idea of what's in that package?
It's been several weeks since I last looked at it. It includes smart reforms, you know, like banning assault rifles, background checks, and a couple of other sort of simple things that we've known have worked for a very long time in different states and making them universal. So universal background checks, I think, is the number one priority of the March for Our Lives. And that's something that every candidate is being asked.
And stopping people with verified mental illness from being able to buy a gun. I mean, it's insane in more ways than one.
How would you do that?
It's the background check part of this.
Yeah, I mean, but what I hate to start up here.
What constitutes a mental illness?
Anybody who sees an analyst or, you know, I mean, what?
Well, if you're under a doctor's care for any kind of mental health issue, getting a gun is not a good idea.
Even regular therapy, though? I mean, come on, Libby.
Well,
exactly, Sarah. So that's my question.
So, you know, this is a problem we have, and I think this is going to come up a lot today because several of our issues all touch on the same thing, which is that we tend to have this very either-or mentality here. You can either allow everything or nothing. And, you know, again, it wouldn't be that hard to come up with some parameters in this space to say if it's certain treatments, when you go to a psychiatric office, you actually have a list. There's a book full of what the diagnoses are. You could simply say if it's certain of those things.
Right.
We know the history of this stuff. We actually aren't allowed to study it formally because we still have laws on the books that ban the government from funding research into this stuff. Because what happens is these things become political issues and start to become election issues, and we lose all ability to make intelligent decisions about where the boundaries should be. And I think that's really hurting us as a country, and it's causing more and more of this kind of separation. And again, you know, there's probably ways to do a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean,
most people are in favor of some kind of
sure
rules. In here.
And I would be one of those callers and listeners who wants to divorce the issue from mental health. Booker's number one priority, I just looked it up while we were chatting, would be a national licensing program, which I can't believe I forgot about. But minimum standards for gun ownership nationwide. You know, in New York State, you're not allowed to touch a pistol while you're obtaining your pistol permit. I think I've mentioned on the program before, I took the NRA pistol permit right. gun safety class. And, you know, if I follow through the licensing process and am able to obtain a permit, then I can theoretically handle a pistol without really knowing how to handle one. And that's something we need to fix in New York to make sure that there's some sort of range test, right? So minimum standards to make sure that anybody who has a gun has cleared the minimum competency beyond just knowledge of what the difference between a pistol, rifle, and semi-automatic weapon are.
So, Sarah, do you think that in this country we have the ability to pass national legislation? Because you're so right. You know, we have all kinds of stuff in New York already, but it doesn't matter if somebody puts, you know, an automatic weapon or something from their in their car from a different state. But I, you know, I don't know. It's this gun culture is pretty extraordinary in this country. It's almost in our fabric.
Well, we can expect that if there's a different president in 2020, and if that president, you know, prioritizes gun control, that they'll be sued by states. I mean, it'll be another question of how far mm-hmm. can the federal government go in making in regulating guns. But that, you know, it's ripe for reopening in terms of case law. It's been a while since we've had some of those cases.
I'm not following. What do you mean in terms of case law?
It's been a while since we've had some serious challenges in the Supreme Court around gun regulation. And so it's been a while because the gun lobby has done so well of making sure that everyone's too scared. Just like immigration, there's been sort of a lag in the federal government really doing anything meaningful at all because of the politics. So,
well, you're the Supreme Court scholar, but I have to say, the idea that the jokers who are sitting up there right now, and I always get letters when I call them jokers, that they're going to...
As you should, they're justices.
Yes.
Well, some of them.
I hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, that's it. That's it. You know, look, when Trump was running for president, I kept saying, what about the Supreme Court? What about the Supreme Court? What about the Supreme Court?
I've been saying that since John Kerry ran.
Yes, you have. And so now we have sown what we reaped or reaped what we've sown. If I think I remember which of those it is, I don't.
So where do we go from, obviously, this is yet another, and we'll find, I guess I just want to follow up on what Sarah, but everyone has been talking about. You mentioned Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, but when does it take, you wonder how many more of these is going to take for this to become a major issue in the campaign? Because it doesn't seem to have been yet.
We'll
see the debates tomorrow night.
Yeah, we'll see what happens tomorrow night. I mean, there are so many other major issues. I mean, the major issue in the Democratic primary is the Orange Menace.
Mm-hmm.
So, and race. I mean, I think the major issue now is race and what he has done over the weekend and what he keeps doing. And he attacked Al Sharpton, and he just keeps it going. He is showing how vile of a racist he really is.
Don't you guys think, though, that the idea that, you know, we have gun issues here relate almost directly to racism itself? In other words, what is this about the guns and why people want guns in mm-hmm. their houses? And, you know, it has always appeared to me that this is racism 101.
The gun wars, drug wars, war on the poor,
right?
The war on immigrants, a lot of it is rooted in racism, for sure.
Well, anytime somebody, I mean, it's getting to the point where, you know, if you say anything bad about the country, you're seen as the other, which then feeds right into racism. And because this country, as much as people don't want to recognize it, was built on racial divide. You know, we had slavery right from the beginning, and that notion of those people, of people of color being the other and not being as valuable other than as a commodity and not as people, has shaped who we are as, and shaped our national psyche and shaped who we are as a country. And racism is institutionalized in the United States in a way that it's not in many other countries.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We do have a couple. Let's begin there. Panel, says Chris, another day, another shooting. Guns have unfortunately won. Gun owners' rights to own are more important in this country than an individual's right to live. Logical arguments to change this are drowned out. That according to Chris. Jen says, I am 100% anti-gun, and I believe that only military personnel, a well-regulated militia, should have access to them. However, Libby, you are wrong. I'm a therapist and an adult with ADHD, a mental health issue, and I'm under the care of a doctor. People with mental health issues are not dangerous as a rule. Stop stigmatizing mental illness. It's why folks don't get help. Love the roundtable, Jen.
So let me just jump in on that one again.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, I do want to be very careful on this, right? If you said anybody who goes to a doctor counts as a medical patient versus somebody who has a chronic disease, somebody who has things. I mean, we know how to categorize mm-hmm. these things. And we have this tendency to lump things too much together. I do agree with both Libby and the writer leader. Who both have said opposite
right.
things.
No, it's,
because, again, it's exactly where you draw the line. And I must admit, I did take I do have a license to practice psychology in Texas, although I think it's expired. But that's the cognitive
science.
Wow,
we need to add that to your bio.
That's why
put another one.
That's why it's computer, web, and cognitive science.
Oh, I see.
My days as a psychologist.
All right.
But not a psychiatrist. Psychologist is very different. But anyway, the I think there you could start with a fairly limited set of diagnoses that really are at the very high end and mm-hmm. are very clear, right? And most of the shooters, at least what we can tell from what's released in the press, because, again, it would be great to be able to do research on this for real, seem to be coming from a fairly narrow band of this where there is a mental issue. There's also a lot of other things obviously involved.
White maleness.
Yeah, there's that.
Michael writes that. Michael sent his gun control plan. You ready? Mm-hmm. I have two simple additions to existing plans: make them less affordable by taxing them highly, require gun owners to carry insurance
on
your car.
Thing. It's the insurance.
You can't register a gun without insurance, but the insurance industry can find a way to handle that problem.
Ooh, an insurance,
which is to make money
out of that.
Yeah.
Make
money out of it.
They'll self-insure. Just wait.
But I want to make a point about the psychiatric issue, and it seems to me that a lot of these guys, people, but they're mostly men. In fact, I don't remember a woman. Do you guys?
No,
not
no.
none of the major.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So most of these people, when they give you the background in the paper, they'll tell you they had no issues. In other words, it's easy enough to say psychiatrically if they went to a psychiatrist, if they went to a psychologist, a social worker, you know. But if in fact there is no real indication that because they woke up one morning and decided to do this horrendous stuff.
Absolutely. But it came on the radar. It really came on the radar after Littleton
Newtown.
And Newtown, where
Newtown.
You had a patient who had extensive mental illness, and then his mother is buying him the weapons. And that's when it came on the radar.
And the guy who shot up the theater in Aurora.
Right.
But well, that's why this is a red herring, guys, because what it's really about is access to guns and who has access to guns. How they get into the hands of individuals who have severe mental health problems is part of the package of that access. But focusing on the root cause and restricting access to guns is why, you know, that's number one on Moms Demand platform, right? Shannon Watts, the spokesperson, is constantly posting study upon study that says that the only thing that will be effective in preventing mass shootings is restricting access to firearms generally.
Right. And the starting place on that has to be the semi-automatics, which we've done in the past. Yeah. There wasn't a hue and cry. In fact, it wasn't the gun owners who demanded we bring it back. It became a political issue. And it came back because it was a way of, quote, law and order candidates claiming that they were in favor of something that their opponents weren't.
Is there any indication? I want to address this to Sarah, who is our Supreme Court expert. But is there any indication that these people are going to do anything on the court to halt access? Quite the contrary, I think.
Well, I'm not a Supreme Court expert, but I will say that...
Well, you're the closest thing we have.
the docket for November doesn't have, to my knowledge, any cases involving a fight over gun control. What we need is the federal government to do something and then states or individuals to challenge it and then for it to work its way through district courts and circuit courts, a circuit split, for the Supreme Court then to grant cert. So you won't see it for a year or more, 2 years, once the federal government actually does something, unless somebody, you know, files suit right away for injunctive relief. But this isn't the types of reforms that we're talking about on gun control are not like the crazy things that are happening, again, with immigration, where they announce some ridiculous policy and then there are grounds to immediately halt it because it's so insane. And that's why you see the Supreme Court acting so quickly in these cases. That's unusual.
In which cases? I'm sorry, sir.
More in immigration cases where things are coming up a lot more quickly because a lot of the states are being, you know, the challenges are coming up in different state circuits faster, and they're being pushed through the system faster.
So let's go to the story about the Baltimore. Actually, let's go to Dan Coats, and then I'll come back and do Baltimore. Dan Coats apparently resigning to step down as intelligence chief. And so, well, what happened? Well, Dan Coats has been on the outs for a little while. So the president announced on Sunday that Dan Coats would step down as the director of the National Intelligence, director of National Intelligence, after a fraught tenure marked by tension with the Oval Office. And he tapped one of his staunch defenders, Representative John Ratcliffe, to take over the country's expansive network of spy agencies. Mr. Coats, a former senator and longtime pillar of the Republican establishment who angered the president by providing unwelcome assessments of Russia, North Korea, and other matters, told Mr. Trump last week that it was time to move on. His departure removes one of the most prominent national security officials willing to contradict the president. If Mr. Ratcliffe is confirmed by the Senate, he will offer a starkly different perspective in the Situation Room, one more in line with Mr. Trump's thinking. Mr. Ratcliffe, a third-term Republican from Texas and a former prosecutor, has embraced Mr. Trump's theories about the Russia investigation and was among the sharpest questioners of Robert Mueller, the former special counsel, at last week's hearings.
So, of all the stories we have today and for several weeks, I got to tell you that I find this one the scariest. That may sound odd, but I do. And the reason is simple. The famous aphorism, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Every time we have had used to be the CIA, now it's the DNI, the people who really are responsible for intelligence, under the White House's thumb, when they feel they must produce intelligence that agrees with the White House, that has led us into trouble. This goes all the way back to the Korean War. We saw this in the 60s. We saw this with Bush in Iraq. I mean, it just happens again and again. This was one of the few people who was willing in this administration to not – it's not so much that he would argue with Trump. It's that he was willing to let the intelligence community – figure out what they thought was the truth, and then he would bring it forward. And it's when that gets quashed, when that gets silenced, that we get into these horrible situations, because now you just get an echo chamber. The president says, I think this is okay.
And that's what he wants.
And if the CIA suppresses the things that would – so if North Korea is doing something positive and you have a president who wants it negative, or they're doing something negative and you want positive, and the president is not tracking that, the entire intelligent things come to the president in the morning as a set of PowerPoint slides that boil everything down. And if the president gets to determine what's in that – It drastically changes how our country responds internationally, and this one really scares me.
Well, it's like,
does anybody really believe that he did this on his own, or that he was pushed? Is my question.
Oh, I think that he was pushed.
I'm sure he was pushed. Yeah. Pretty much everyone believes that Ratcliffe's performance. His performance on the Mueller thing.
God.
Seemed like, you know, an audition for this.
Well, that in and of itself is scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we are losing our last intelligence chief. I mean, that's basically the bottom line here. And while I didn't agree with Dan Coats politically on many things, you know, he's one of these guys who believes in the law. He believes in the government, and he believes in speaking truth to power when it comes to this sort of stuff. Otherwise,
he's one of the old Republicans.
He's one of the old Republicans. He wouldn't have been there. And Jim's right. It is very scary because this president wants to declare war, he wants everybody around him to agree. There's no more best and brightest. It's the dullest than the dullards.
Well, and it's a manipulation of our deepest secrets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jared Kushner still has security clearance.
Right. That's
Why?
Insane.
Why? So it's a deprofessionalization of our.
It's the politicization of intelligence,
of
intelligence, of national security, and that's the one thing. When it's not politicized, we usually stay safe. When it becomes politicized, is when we end up.
That's the key.
In war.
And it's worth noting that a lot of the people in the intelligence community are amazingly devoted. So I used to live down in Maryland. I used to work very closely with a lot of these people. I still can get in trouble if I even tell you what my clearances are. But if anyone wants somebody to refute QAnon, my clearances are higher than theirs. But anyway, these people are working their butts off to figure out what's going on. Some of the ways they do it,
and to keep
prove
us
of,
safe.
Some makes me nervous. But all of these are people whose patriotism is not. Mm. Patriotism in the sense of, you know, I'm going out in my backyard and I'm building a shelter and out with everyone else. And it really, you know, making a lot of these people I know have been very nervous. They've been thinking about retiring. You know, they're hitting their 20 years and out, where these used to be people who would stay on for more years. They became the senior management. So it's not just that we're damaging it short term, but we're going to risk damaging it long term in just our abilities.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I'm thinking of the thing where of that moment when there was Coates on the air with his interviewer, and he was totally blindsided about Putin coming to the White House. He didn't know it. There was nervous laughter. He said, that'll be interesting. It was a terrible moment because it showed, when you talk about the security of this country, our number one enemy in terms of having tried to bring down the Democratic Party by the Russians, by campaigning against them and being insidious with this whole thing, that's extraordinary to me. And that tells you more about what you're saying than anything else, which is, hey, this really is dangerous.
Yep.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post make up the panel. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. So let's go to the story that a lot of people are talking about this morning that happened over the weekend, and that was the president's attack on Elijah Cummings and, weirdly, on the entire city of Baltimore. So the president's denunciations of Baltimore as an uninhabitable city are the latest in a string of disparaging attacks on a diverse liberal enclave as violent, dirty, and outside the mainstream. Rhetoric that paints those areas of the country as fundamentally less American than whiter, more conservative strongholds. Trump denigrated Maryland's largest city over the weekend as a disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess. He blamed it on Representative Elijah Cummings, the Democrat who is black, and claimed on Sunday that the lawmaker himself is racist. Long before Trump had taken aim at other major cities, some of which are predominantly African-American, and their elected leaders. He called San Francisco streets disgusting. He labeled Oakland and Ferguson among the most dangerous places in the world and lambasted the crime spree and terrible blight in the city of Chicago. When he went after John Lewis shortly after his inauguration, he also called that a crime-infested city as well. So, this is very typical of the president in the sense that there has been coverage of this, and then he and I hate using this phrase of double downs. I just hate it, so I won't use it. But you get the idea.
Doubled down.
Yeah.
He just did,
and then went back. And Libby alluded to this earlier to going after Al Sharpton and others. So. What I guess, Alan, this is more of the same, and yet it certainly shows a pattern. And I guess you would have to say that he thinks that this is working for him. But
absolutely.
Yeah,
that's what he thinks. He thinks it got him elected the last time. He thinks it'll get him elected this time. And you can see what's happening now. Al Sharpton happens to be one of the most popular figures among black voters and black citizens. And yet, I am sure that they're polling to try to find out which people are most likely to be not liked by their base. And I think Sharpton probably figures heavily in that. You know, when Sharpton ran for senator in New York, I believe he got 90% of the black vote, 90%. So we have no question that this president, who is on a racist trope, that's what he's doing, and thinks it's going to win for him. And we can only hope he's wrong. Now, there are many black commentators who will tell you that the danger here is that black voters, which are capable of carrying this election, will be so disgusted that they'll walk away. That's the problem here.
And that's his strategy.
Yeah.
Yep. Suppressing the vote and then empowering people. You know, I had an unfortunate exchange right after the election. I decided to dig in and have tough conversations with people who I knew were Trump supporters, people that I went to high school with back in Michigan, people that I went to college with. I had to stop pretty soon after I started that experiment just because it was so disheartening. But one of the exchanges, actually, it was somebody from my high school reached out to me and said, you know, I was gonna disagree with you publicly about your political stance, but I'm just going to send you this message instead. And, you know, we had a pretty productive back and forth about a whole host of issues, including insurance and the Affordable Care Act and all kinds of things. But then it got to a point where it was like, well, you live in the big city and you have forgotten, you know, your rural roots and where you came from. And you've been brainwashed by that big city you live in. And I had to remind him that I lived in
Albany, in a
community outside but in his head, I lived in New York City.
Well, it's because that's what they think of New York.
Right. Yeah. Because I was from New York City, I didn't understand the plight of the rural Midwest.
But I loved your line there where you said you forgot where you came from, because that's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it's definitely a challenge. Trump definitely knows what he's doing. I ended the conversation by saying I really hope that his election helps with your insurance premiums, but I'm guessing it won't, thinking, like, maybe I'll loop back around in a couple of years and see where they are on that. Because it was really, like, remember back when he was first elected, the idea that it was, like, you know, middle class and poor white people who felt disenfranchised and wanted to come out and vote. Because they felt like he was their person. He understood them. I'm very curious to follow up with those folks, not personally, but through surveys or what have you, to figure out where they are now.
What do you think? Where do you think they are right now? Because all the polling indicates they're right where they always have been.
Yeah. Well, that's disheartening, to say the least.
So, you know, we've said this before on the show, so I won't go into it again, but the numbers all are obvious. It's if the Democratic voters, particularly in the urban areas, come out to vote, it will change the election.
Like in states like Michigan.
And particularly in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
Florida.
And there was key... It could even take it without Florida, actually, if you could get. So it was the suburbs.
You mean Pennsylvania.
It was the suburbs purple, and it was the inner city lower voting rates.
Right.
Now, some of that was actual suppression, but a lot of that was just that Trump managed to build this narrative that got people to stay home. And now he's already working on that. And so I think... Regardless who you believe in, getting out to vote is going to be the difference this year.
We can't forget what happened in 2018. I will say this until 2020 is over. You know, we can't forget what happened in 2018. There was a massive blue wave. These people have not disappeared. I think, you know, his racism is galvanizing a lot of people across a lot of different sectors. You know, when you talk about voter suppression, we've got a situation going on right across the river in Rensselaer County. When the early voting, they put two early voting places out in the suburbs, but not in the city of Troy. Yep. And that's where all the people of color are, and all the poor people, and people who don't have access to their own transportation. And so it's outrageous that, but this goes along with the rest of the things that are going on in Rensselaer County in terms of the treatment of the immigrants, undocumented immigrants, suing against the green light bill to give licenses. So it's part of that trope over there with that administration across the river. But, you know, we have our own little case of voter suppression going on right up here in New York.
That's right.
Well, let's also remember a small thing like the gerrymander.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the idea that you have a democracy where people from the people get to make all the decisions just turns out not to be so.
Mm-hmm. When I just want to look back on Baltimore, it seems that Elijah Cummings' handling of this. I mean, the guy is a pretty
saint.
I mean, he's a very upstanding representative, and you know, I guess we went through this obviously with John Lewis as well. He's well liked, even loved in the community, and you wonder if this is a, you know, he certainly seems like a good person to. A person who's up for the fight, let's say.
I saw this morning. I lived in Baltimore for 2 years, so I take this pretty personally as well. And I know I've spent time in Baltimore neighborhoods, all of them actually. And it's a beautiful city. It's a wonderfully diverse community, and it faces challenges just like any major city. I saw on Twitter that there was a flight that was headed back to Baltimore last night, and the flight attendants got on the sound system and said something about, you know, soon we'll be landing in beautiful, diverse,
lovely. Must have been Southwest.
Yeah, and the entire plane erupted in a cheer.
Yeah.
Now, presumably, they were all going back home. An evening flight back to Baltimore, so they were all friendlies already. But those are the stories that I'm clinging to. Like the people don't buy it.
And by the way, the stats are that the district itself is not nearly what is impoverished or otherwise has been said.
Of course, it's not.
No way. I mean, Baltimore is such a weird patchwork of communities that I mean, it's unlike any other place I've ever been in America.
I would just like to say any city that can have as one of their city heroes and give the key to John Waters.
Yeah, right, right.
Hairspray is like...
That's right.
I mean, if you have John Waters...
We need to hear Good Morning Baltimore.
I love it, yes.
That's what we need to hear.
John Waters and Ann Tyler are pretty good representatives for your city.
What about crab cakes?
Right, and the Orioles on occasion.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back
and the
we'll
Ravens.
Continue our conversation right after this. Talking about 80s musical theater. That's where the conversation has right. gone somehow out of our conversation in Baltimore. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the roundtable. It is the 29th of July. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post. Let's go to some letters. Michael says, arts and culture festivals in the Albany region already struggle to pay for the higher cost of security associated with potential gun violence. Why is regulating community arts more acceptable than regulating access to guns?
Good point. That's a great hot take.
Daniel says, I am from Baltimore and miss it terribly. Trump has obviously never been to Baltimore. As the Baltimore Sun editorial said, I'm paraphrasing, it is better to have some vermin in your neighborhood than to be one.
Yes.
Wow. The listeners are on fire today.
Yeah. Well, I did think the Baltimore Sun editorial was great. It was a great editorial. William says the president did the citizens of Baltimore a great service by using his bully pulpit to call out Elijah Cummings' inept leadership and its disastrous results. For decades, Cummings has been treated like a sacred cow, protected by Democrats and the mass media. No one can disrupt the status quo like Donald Trump.
Okay.
You know, to be honest, this is why his voters are still with him, is that kind of belief.
Yes,
right.
Is that breaking thing, that something that our system is broken and the only way to fix it is to break it more, which is something I don't fully understand. But it's when you get into that mentality, you can say things like that. There was a letter supporting him in the Times Union on Sunday. Same sort of thing. Like, how could he be a racist? He appointed Ben Carson. That's like my best friends are.
Well, and if you look at Mitch McConnell's district, it actually, I think three out of the 10 poorest counties in America are in mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell's district. Why isn't he being called a sacred cow?
So life expectancy among males is lower in the red states than the blue states. Again, you know.
Food stamps, the highest subscription to food stamps is in red states. I mean, it's mind-boggling, but then we can't confuse people with the facts because, you know, it's alternative. Right. It's what the facts, the truth is what you want it to be, not what it is.
The gaslighting of America.
That's right.
This is a large part of the story that we didn't talk about, but Larry brings it up, and I'm glad he did. It is noteworthy that the president's top advisor, Jared Kushner, is also a large property owner in the city of Baltimore. In fact, his family real estate company owns tracts of rental property in the very neighborhood his father-in-law affronted. The Kushner family has become profiteers from the rat-infested streets, and once again, Dumb Donald is part of the problem and not the solution. The article in the New York Times points out that one of the reasons that the neighborhood or the was it Kushnerville? Was that actual name of it, or was that
I think that's what they call it.
That was a. In doing one of the reasons that it was had been cited by the city was because that it was indeed rat infested.
Right. I mean, that's been a problem in communities in Baltimore for a long time, are developers who sit on their rights and do nothing with the property and let them decay. And there's no way for the city to challenge their rights. That's been a systemic issue in Baltimore for decades.
Alan, one in?
No, I think everybody's doing a terrific job.
Okay. All right. Just checking. let's go to another story making news, and that is the asylum deal. Let me back up, and we'll do the one that we would have done on Saturday if we had a show. And that was the Supreme Court and the border wall funding. I don't want that story to get lost. The Supreme Court rules for Donald Trump in border wall funding dispute. The Supreme Court on Friday handed President Trump a major victory by clearing the way for him to divert $2.5 billion from the military's budget and to use it to build an extra 100 miles of border wall in California, Arizona, and New Mexico. The justices, by a vote of 5-4, lifted orders by a federal judge in Oakland and the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco that had barred the administration from using the Pentagon's money to build a border wall. Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's four other conservatives joined in ruling for the Trump administration. They questioned whether the Sierra Club and other plaintiffs had standing to challenge the government's spending policy. The four liberals on the court dissented.
Well, Sarah, as soon as I saw that news come flashing across, the only thing I could think of was you, because I know that you could not have been a happy camper right then.
It's tough when these decisions don't go the way that we believe that they should, but it is a pretty narrow issue. It's on standing, and it's sort of like if you mm-hmm. can find different plaintiffs, then fine. And even one of the voters in the majority was like, this is going to be terrible for the environment. I can't vote I have to vote with the majority on standing. But otherwise, I would block this because it's going to ruin.
So who has standing for the environment? I mean, that's the thing, you know, and for the animals.
Well, I think probably the ACLU, which was one of the organizations that brought suit along with the Sierra Club and then a local environmental organization. I can't imagine that they didn't spot this weakness and know that was an issue going into this. So I wouldn't be surprised if for the last several months they've been cultivating other plaintiffs.
But can't they always do that? I mean, can't they always say standing? I mean, we're all United States citizens, right? Or many of us are anyway.
So you should have Ray Brescia on the show because there's some interesting stuff happening with standing, particularly under this administration. There was some interesting standing issues with the Muslim ban. This is actually, I believe, the first time in a while that they've ruled on the standing issue. Typically, they punt that issue, sort of, you know, push it under the rug and not really look at it. Ray Brescia, my colleague at Albany Law School, wrote a brilliant article looking at a bunch of different areas, including immigration and the Supreme Court, and sort of analyzing where they are on the standing issue. So this might not be about immigration at all. It might be more about the Supreme Court deciding to actually take on these standing issues because they're going to see them over and over and over again with this president. And they kind of have to clean house a little bit on the case law.
When it comes to the actual... I mean, looking at what we are, what we're talking here of the, what is 100 miles? So what are they, what's, now what? Now what happens?
Well, there are lots of other legal challenges that are pending, right? You guys remember Cards Against Humanity, like purchased?
Yes. Yes.
There's also like just geographical limitations. There are places along the border where you can't build a wall. It's physically nearly impossible. And we have to remind everyone that Donald Trump has not completed even a mile of border wall fencing to date.
It's almost finished.
And we're talking a tiny amount of money. I mean, what could the country do with $2.5 billion other than, say, help us with health care and some of these poverty issues and all these things he's running against?
Yeah. I mean, it's another diversion of resources to the border.
But it goes right to the base.
Sure.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Richard writes, I don't understand why after incidents like this past weekend when President Trump made derogatory vermin-like statements about Representative Elijah Cummings in the city of Baltimore, his supporters get so indignant when people call Trump a racist. This actually fires up the Trump base. Do you really think he's not racist, or is it all just a game?
Well, they don't want to admit that they're racist. That's part of this. Because if their president is racist, then they must be racist as well. And honestly, any Trump supporter or anyone at this point who can't own up to the fact that this man is a racist is racist themselves. And I'll stand by that comment. I'm sure you'll get plenty of letters, but it's true. I mean, we need to recognize the race baiting that got this man elected and how he has continued it, and that the fact that if you speak out against this country, you are then the racist because you're speaking out against white people. I mean, give me a break. This is we've gotten to the point where left is right, right is left, up is down, and down is up. I mean, nobody.
Yeah, the president says the Democrats. See, they always play the race card.
Then called Elijah Cummings a racist.
I know.
I mean, there used to be this sense of dignity, even within the Republican Party, and decorum, knowing that you can't call a black person a racist, understanding where racism comes from. But this president has given them all license. So.
the word racism doesn't mean anything anymore.
No, not
we have
really.
To come up with a new word.
Yeah. Well, and then that won't mean much either, because they'll just be able to, because the media pays so much attention to Trump and gives him so much credibility and value, he'll just be able to redefine things over and over and over again.
We got this letter from George that says it is true that predators attack the weakest in the herd. If true, Predator Trump has chosen well. Baltimore's troubles have been constantly in the news. Socialism as a notion still raises a red flag for most people in the country. Al Sharpton's early history is not so stellar. Who does the nation have who can effectively answer Trump back? I don't see anyone on the horizon. John Stewart, question mark? That from George.
How about Barack Obama?
Yeah, how about the President's Club needs to band together and do the right thing here. They all need to start speaking out. The only one who's doing it really are the wives.
And Jimmy Carter.
And Jimmy Carter. That's it.
Eileen says there was another mass shooting this weekend, this one much closer to home. At least two gunmen opened fire upon people attending the Old Timers Day in Brooklyn. One killed, 11 wounded. The gunmen are still at large. For some reason, this act of terrorism is not getting as much coverage as the incident in California. I don't understand why.
That's a good question.
I saw lots of reports on it over the weekend, but I'm glad that this caller mentioned it so that it got airtime here.
Cotty says that Bernie Sanders blasted Baltimore as a third world country. Residents of Baltimore's poorest boroughs have lifespans shorter than people living under dictatorships in North Korea. That is a disgrace. By Democrat rules, Bernie qualifies as a racist. Trump exposing racism from the left. The previous Baltimore mayor described the rat-infested conditions, the smell of dead rats. Dems like Cummings can deny any crisis at the border when it is obvious, then jump on the bandwagon when they can't deny it anymore, then refuse to negotiate on fixing it. If the conditions at the border were the same as in Baltimore, the outrage would be doubled.
Wow. There's a lot to unpack there. And I just want to remind people that a lot of what happened in Baltimore and a lot of the media attention, the last big national media story was when Freddie Gray was mistreated and died at the hands of police officers in one of the most disgusting episodes of police brutality against a black youth that we've seen in a very long time. And so I struggle when we paint with these broad brushes. What's happening at the border is extremely complicated. And yes, if we were holding children of the age of 3 down to infants in cages and separating them from their parents, and it was happening anywhere closer to our backyard, absolutely there would be more of an outrage. So I agree on that point. But I won't take the bait when it comes to Baltimore or to the Democrats playing politics with this issue, either the border or what's happening in our inner cities.
And while we're on the subject, Sarah, talk just for a second about Guatemala and what's going on there now.
So the president claims to have struck a deal, although there's some internal unrest in Guatemala among the governors, the governing bodies, with respect to whether or not it was entered into at all, and whether or not, if it was entered into following the proper procedures of the government in Guatemala. But what it would do is it's a safe third country agreement, which we've heard come up before in the context of Mexico and Canada, where essentially, if you look at a map and see where Guatemala is, it's the linchpin between Mexico and Honduras and El Salvador. So you have to pass through Guatemala to get to Mexico, to get to the southern border. So they're targeting Guatemala and saying migrants have to first file a claim for asylum in Guatemala before they can try to file a claim in the United States.
Migrants from where?
Anywhere.
In other words, anything south of there. Also
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like the whole world migrates through that. It's not just Hondurans and Salvadorans and Nicaraguans who migrate through Guatemala. It's the whole world. People find their way to South America and come through that way because for lots of complicated reasons. But people from the Middle East, people from the continent of Asia, like there are lots of people where that's the route because it's so hard to come directly to the United States via air. So there are lots and lots of different issues to unpack. Kirk Semple wrote a great piece in the New York Times, sort of breaking it down and explaining the top questions. But the biggest issue is that Guatemala isn't necessarily equipped to take in that number of asylum seekers or asylum seekers generally. It's questionable whether under international law, whether the conditions are right in Guatemala to provide safe haven for refugees fleeing violence from other countries. So we have Guatemalans who come to the United States for fear, different reasons, mm-hmm. political or otherwise. So lots and lots and lots of issues around this, and it remains to be seen whether or not this agreement will go into effect, and if so, how it will, whether and how it will change migration patterns.
So how can the Guatemalan brass really fight back against this if they want anything from Trump? I mean, think about the relationship between this giant, you know, force, the United States, and little tiny Guatemala. Mm. I mean, do they really have any way of saying, you know, screw you?
Well, he's banking on them not, but then how effective are they going to be able to be? I mean, they will flag for him, as the Mexican officials did, how ill-equipped they are to handle it. And, I mean, we're just making an international migration crisis worse.
Yes, but he wanted a victory, and he's claiming he got one.
So, you know, he bullied mm-hmm. again.
Yes,
you know, this is
exactly.
This is what's been happening. He's been using trade sanctions as mm-hmm. a threat, forces people on. Then now what'll happen is I wouldn't be at all surprised if Guatemala backs down on this. You know, in other words, their internal courts have said this can't happen. They're, you know, as that gets done, no one will hear about it. It will fade out of the press. And then whether they do it or not,
he'll still
Trump
claim
is seen
on the,
as having been on, seen
yep,
to have won.
It'll be part of his stump speech. Yeah. I won. All, this is another
you.
Thing
exactly.
that I won. I'm tough on immigrants.
I know. It's keeping his feet to the fire. And, you know, he'll call it fake media, but the media must do it.
What does it mean for other areas around, as you said, I mean, around Guatemala of other countries? I mean, what else? So what standing and precedent does this set?
Well, we saw what happened in the European Union around the Syria crisis, where we had Syrian refugees fleeing to different places. And when European countries tried to shut that down, people died. And that's what we will see. People will die. I hope that there's news coverage when that happens. I hope that the international monitors, and I'm sure that they will, international monitors have been at the border condemning the United States practices there. But I hope this will be an issue that the international community takes up and then calls us to reckon for at some point.
Okay, we're good? All right. I just wanted to check that nobody had anything else to say on that point. Okay. And now let us go to the final story that we have for this morning, and that is a colonel accused a four-star general of sexual assault. A Senate panel will decide what happens next.
A Senate panel. Well,
yep. What'd you say, Lip?
A Senate panel. Ha ha. Ha ha ha.
General John...
the same people who brought us Brett Kavanaugh.
General John Hyten's chances of being confirmed as the military's second highest officer may come down to one thing this week, whether senators believe an Army colonel's charges that he sexually assaulted her while she was under his command, accusations that he denies. Colonel Catherine, and I'm hoping I get this name correctly, but it's Splethoser, I believe?
Splethoser.
Splethoser is how I heard it pronounced earlier, but I could be wrong on it.
Yeah, who knows?
I stopped believing NPR that they had the correct pronunciations all the time. But anyway, she has accused Hyten, who is currently responsible for the country's nuclear arsenal as the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, of making unwanted sexual contact with her on several occasions in 2017 while the two were traveling for work. Both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate Armed Services Committee maintain that her account is plausible, but some members have also said that they are wary of taking her uncorroborated word over the categorical denials of a decorated four-star Air Force general endorsed by high-ranking colleagues. The Air Force's Office of Special Investigations investigated the allegations but could not substantiate her claims. In a statement, the U.S. Strategic Command spokesman a man by the name of Bill Clinton, not the one you're thinking of, said the command had fully cooperated with the probe, noting that Air Force officials found that there was insufficient evidence to support any finding of misconduct on the part of General Hyten.
You know, this woman,
the colonel,
and Christine Blasey Ford, why would they come forward? Why would they subject themselves to such media scrutiny as well as scrutiny of their peers, and what will no doubt be a harangue from the right, unless something did happen?
Well, the other thing about this, and Sarah, you could speak to this, I think, about timing. So many of these cases are so far removed. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And that is always a way of saying, well, why, you know, why are they bringing it up now? Well, she brought this up right away. I mean, this is only two years ago. This is right away was brought up. So when words are used like uncorroborated, once it's immediately reported, how then is an investigation not have more substantive results, I guess?
Well, some of it has to do with the victim in a very short period of time coming to grips with what just happened to her, having to make decisions that will have deep ramifications for her and her entire family, for the future of her professional career, especially. That's why this is always a higher-ranking individual against a lower-ranking individual. She reported it right away, but she also disguised her identity for when she released information to the Associated Press, because she wasn't ready to be identified. And she probably was advised to do that so that she wasn't prematurely targeted. If you remember, Blasey Ford had to hire private security.
Right.
And she still lives under constant scrutiny. I don't know that she's back at her old job. So this colonel faces a long uphill battle, and she needed to make sure that she could document it before revealing her identity. And that's what makes these things kind of tricky. It is very different, though, in that that she reported it right away. I don't want to privilege that over Blasey Ford's experience because of the age difference. You know, when you're older,
right.
and you have more resources available to you, and thanks to our Senator Gillibrand, there are more protections for women in the military. So these are the things, you know, that contribute to the delayed release of information.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody, Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post. Thank you all for being with us this morning. We always welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org. We will continue with more of the roundtable after this short break.